Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Recession worries took a backseat to bargains today. The Black Friday frenzy descended in full force on the nation's shopping malls. With only 28 days left in the holiday spending spree, retailers are offering customers more than just a place to plunk down the plastic. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday, the 26th day of November. All right, for those of you who braved the stores on this Black Friday or any time recently, here's a question. How was the service? Did you notice friendlier sales staff? Maybe a clerk going out of his way to bring you that smaller size in the dressing room? If you answered yes, it probably was not an accident. As Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us, customer service may be making a comeback in a tough economy.
Macy's flagship store in Manhattan was crawling this morning, with shoppers, sure, but also with extra attentive staff.
They're everywhere. You know, you turn around and you're bumping into them. So, I mean,
Debbie and Leonard Ormsby were visiting from Canada.
And all you have to do is ask, and they tell you what you're looking for and where it is.
And all courteous, yeah. All very helpful.
Retailers often pull out the stops on Black Friday, but Wendy Liebman with WSL Strategic Retail says they're trying harder in general these days. Shoppers are still reluctant to part with their money, and stores can only cut prices so low.
What retailers have come to learn is that shoppers have become tightwads, understandably so. They've got to find ways to budge them, and I think that's where they're seeing service as a component that can make a difference.
Liebman says department stores in particular are returning to old-fashioned customer service, sometimes with a modern twist. This year, Macy's expanded its search and send service. If you can't find something in a store, a clerk will search online and have it shipped to you. But don't expect attention like that everywhere you shop. Analyst Ken Perkins of Retail Metrics says many stores are still light on staff after cutting back during the recession. And he says discounters can't afford to offer bargains and star treatment, too.
If price is your primary objective and you're trying to stretch your dollar, I think most consumers are willing to sacrifice some customer service for that.
Analyst Wendy Liebman says retailers trying to go the extra mile should be careful to strike the right balance. One listener who wrote in said she got so used to being ignored while shopping, the new attention felt almost intrusive. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And we've got a Black Friday slideshow, photos from across the country at marketplace.org. The president spent his morning not at the mall, but on the basketball court, where he apparently took an elbow to the lip, requiring 12 stitches. Insurance will cover it, of course. In the meantime, the health reform law is only 8 months old, and it is already facing challenges on several fronts. On Monday, the Senate is likely to take the first step in rolling back a requirement that businesses report to the IRS every contract worth more than $600. It's supposed to crack down on tax evasion and help pay for health insurance for more Americans. But companies have complained the paperwork will cost them too much time and money. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
The IRS figures to collect an extra $17 billion in revenue if only the government knew about business contracts that now fly below the radar. So the health reform law requires companies to file a 1099 form for every contract worth over $600 a year. For some businesses, that means keeping track of thousands of transactions, not to mention the cost of filling out new paperwork. And since those costs are tax deductible, Keith Ashmus with the National Small Business Association says it won't generate that much revenue.
On the one hand, the government is thinking they might be getting some more money from people who now aren't paying taxes. And on the other hand, they're certainly going to be losing taxes from the businesses that are now paying because they now have less profits because they're having deductible expenses to fill out 1099 forms.
Ashmus says small businesses have picked the 1099 reporting requirement as their first challenge to the health law. They worry companies will try to avoid filling out the forms by reducing the number of contracts they enter into.
So the tendency will be to consolidate your purchases of services and goods from fewer and fewer businesses. So instead of going to five small businesses, you might go to one large business, and that cuts off small businesses from a major source of where they get their income.
Even President Obama concedes the reporting requirement is counterproductive, so a repeal is likely. The only question appears to be how to pay for the $17 billion in lost revenue. Republicans hope to take it out of other health reform accounts. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Call it the McDonald's Index. The fast food chain is raising the price of a burger, fries, and a Coke at all of its 1,200 locations in China. It's the latest sign of sky-high inflation to hit the world's second biggest economy. The Chinese government will try price controls and raising interest rates to curb inflation, but will it be enough? Our China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai.
Ivy Lee just bought a pound of kiwis and 2 pounds of oranges at a fruit stall near her office in Shanghai. Pop music from the shop next door fills the street, but Lee's not in the mood for it. She feels like she just got ripped off.
The prices have gone up so much. All this fruit costs around 40% more than it did last year.
You know things are bad when the price of rice goes up in China. The country's staple grain is up 60% from a year ago. The government's blamed crop damage from summer flooding, but it's becoming clear there's more to the problem. Lee's not sure what it is, but she knows what it isn't.
This isn't the government's fault. It's because foreign companies are coming to China and competing unfairly. The government just needs to figure out what to do.
If only economists shared Lee's theory. China economist Andy Hsieh says Beijing hasn't done much about inflation because it doesn't want to admit what's really wrong.
The reason why the government has been so slow in handling inflation is because it touches on the core issue of income distribution.
Hsieh says more money is flowing to the government than to the people. Local governments are flush with cash from property taxes, and state-owned enterprises aren't doing bad either. But wages for Chinese workers aren't keeping up. When you add record-breaking inflation to the mix, you've got a problem, says Hsieh.
So every episode of social instability in China originated with inflation.
The thing is, China's government has a good memory for this sort of thing. Hsieh says it's a good bet Beijing will raise interest rates again before the year is through, another measure to try and curb inflation. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Wall Street fell into a post-Turkey slump on a shortened trading day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Despite the Thanksgiving holiday, there was plenty of financial news to feast on this week. An insider trading investigation, the next dominoes in Europe's debt crisis, and a bounty of buyouts, J.Crew and Del Monte being at the top of the list. Joining us for a look back at the week on Wall Street and beyond are Felix Salmon of Reuters and New York Times Dealbook contributor Heidi Moore. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Tess.
Hi, Tess.
So you guys body check anyone at the mall this morning?
I took out at least three people.
Awesome.
I woke up at 3 a.m. to go to Macy's. That's how I spend my Black Friday.
Very, very proud of both of you. All right. Well, let's start with insider trading. Earlier this week, the FBI raided the offices of several hedge funds. And this is all about how far inside a company analysts can go to get information that they then share with their clients. Now, Felix, let me start with you. There is an argument that, hey, this is just how Wall Street works. So is this much ado about nothing or deserving of a legal spotlight?
If you look at the arrest that was made this week, it looks like there was crossing of the line to an egregious degree. The experts that were being paid to give information were not being paid just to give sort of generalized expertise about their own industries, but to give very, very specific information about what their own companies were going to reveal in terms of earnings and revenues and that kind of thing. And that's clearly inside information. And if that was happening, then that's clearly criminal.
Heidi, it seems like the government is really showing a lot of muscle in kind of the post-crisis years, post-Madoff years. But how useful is it to go after insider trading?
If you look at trading in a lot of stocks before mergers, it looks incredibly suspicious. I've reported on it. Other reporters have. It just doesn't square with how the normal markets would work unless people knew that these stocks were going to spike due to a merger. Hmm. So they've taken on a very good cause. The problem is insider trading is incredibly hard to prove and has been that way for years. So the FBI started this investigation 3 years ago. So 2007, if you can think about that.
Let's hop across the pond quickly where this week Ireland was bailed out by the Eurozone and the IMF. Felix, how badly does this hurt the Eurozone as a whole?
I have grave misgivings about what's going on in Ireland and the way in which all of the bank debts were nationalized and ultimately taken on by the Eurozone and by Brussels, because these are debts which the Eurozone can't afford to pay, certainly not across the continent as a whole, and it just makes the entire project that much less sustainable and that much more likely to fall apart.
But of course, what we're hearing is that this is far from the end of it all. I mean, Portugal came out with a budget today, but there's talk about Spain. Could Italy be in trouble? Heidi, it is shocking to me that there's actually talk this week that the euro may die.
I don't think it's shocking. I think it's long overdue.
Wow.
And the euro,
it's
the
less
euro
than 10 years
always,
old.
Yes, and it's had a good run, and it's time to send it off into the grave now. It's more than anyone expected, to tell you the truth. What we've seen here, though, is exactly what's wrong with the euro, right? Which is that all of these countries are interconnected, which is good in theory. But once the bailouts start, all of a sudden the other countries are like, what do we have to do with Ireland? You know, who is Greece
right.
to us? I mean, this is a continent that has never been united in the history of humanity. And now all of a sudden, it's kind of this artificial structure that's been imposed on them. And I think also what you see with these bailouts is that you're not really bailing out the countries. You're bailing out the people who bought the debt of those countries.
Yeah.
And so that really is banks and it's hedge funds. And once they get that bailout, it shows them that it's profitable to speculate on those troubled securities. And so we really have a huge element of moral hazard here.
Well, let's move quickly now to these buyouts. This week, a private company bought J. Crew, and just today, a KKR bought Del Monte Foods. These are not huge buyouts, but Felix, it does seem like a busy time for M&A activity recently.
Debt is incredibly cheap, and so this is the same old debt-fueled bubble that we saw in the 2000s, and it is probably all going to end in tears all over again.
I can't disagree. What you have here is that these private equity firms that spent so much money during the boom are currently trying to refinance all that debt that they took on then. So they don't have a lot of access to debt to finance new deals. So they're going back to companies they already know where they don't have to commit a whole lot of money. These are small deals, but they're big consumer names. And so it tells us something about the effect of the recession on some of our best known companies.
Heidi, Felix, thanks so much. Happy holidays.
Thank you, Tess. You too.
Cheers.
Coming up, why we can't get enough of Monopoly.
It provides people with an opportunity to pretend that they're rich, even if real life is not treating them so well.
But first, let's do the numbers. More worries over Europe's debt crisis dragged down the markets today. The Dow fell 95 points in shortened trading, more than 0.8% to close at 11,092. The Nasdaq lost 8 points, about a third of a percent, to end at 2534. And the S&P 500 also slid 8 points, 0.75% to finish at 1189. For the week, the Dow gave back 1%, the S&P 500 shed 0.9%, but the Nasdaq picked up 0.7%. The news that private equity group KKR is planning to buy Del Monte pushed shares of that food company higher by 4.75%. Financials went the other direction. Shares of JPMorgan Chase tanked almost 1.75%. B of A gave back 1.4%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Monday. The Capitol Christmas tree will arrive in Washington, D.C. This year's tree is a 67-foot spruce from Wyoming. Congress reconvenes. High on the agenda? Tax cuts, of course. And on this day in 1934, the Chicago Bears defeated the Detroit Lions in the first national radio broadcast of an NFL game. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Unless Congress votes to extend unemployment benefits again, some 2 million Americans will exhaust their safety net by the end of the year. The news puts that much pressure on job seekers in a weak labor market. New Hampshire resident Stacey Johnson helped bind books before she lost her job more than a year ago. Her husband Bob is a contractor, but work is hard to come by. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Dan Gorenstein profiles a family that is struggling while living on unemployment checks.
Stacey Johnson can't remember who first came up with the term.
The cellar dwellers.
That's what Johnson and her husband call themselves. For the past few years, the couple and their 26-year-old son have lived in a corner of Johnson's parents' basement. There's a toaster, microwave, and mini fridge along one wall. Johnson jokes it's their kitchenette. A black and fluorescent green curtain divides the room.
Just to kind of add privacy between, you know, our side and where my son sleeps.
When the three moved in, they planned to pay Johnson's parents $30 a week to help with rent. But that stopped in August after Bob exhausted all of his benefits. Stacy's $133 a week unemployment check can only stretch so far. Her dad, a retired school maintenance man, has had to eat into his pension fund. And in a few days, Stacy's check is likely to disappear. She says she's not ready.
Not yet. I'm not done yet. I'm not done with school. It can't end yet. It's got to stay there so we can make it.
See, Johnson's got a plan. At 50, she's gone back to school. If Congress extends benefits again, she can wrap up her classes by next spring. And at that point, she'll try for a job in medical administration that pays from $12 to $15 an hour. If there's no extension, Johnson's plan gets thrown into the air. She feels like Washington politicians just don't care.
It sucks because they're not asking me. They're not asking my husband. They're not asking the people I go to school with. They have no right to make a decision on my life or anybody else's life that's struggling, whether we should have money or not.
Johnson's wondered if she should just forget it and find some job, any job. But she says she sees better days ahead. She can feel it.
My husband and I would both some days have our days where we just feel like we're never going to get out from underneath. The other one's there to pick that one up and say, things are going to change. Don't know when, but it's going to change.
Until then, Johnson's husband Bob says the couple holds on to their dreams.
I'd like to have my own place, my own door to walk through, go to the store, be able to buy a name brand can of soup. Maybe have a motorcycle out in the yard. Not much.
For Johnson, she remembers a weekend trip to Maine. She wants that feeling again. walking across marshland to the ocean, looking out and away. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
So we've just heard that it's shaping up to be a not very festive, nail-bitey type of holiday season for lots of American families struggling through long-term unemployment. So what about that debate over extending jobless benefits? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been following the story and joins us from Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Tess.
So first, let's just review where we are with these unemployment extensions and the battle to fund them in Congress.
Well, in every recent recession, Congress has stepped up to pay for what are called extended unemployment benefits. They kick in after 6 months. That's when people run out at the state level. Right now, you can get up to 99 weeks. It's nearly 2 years. The checks average around $300 a week. This is expensive for taxpayers. We've spent more than $100 billion so far. Work it out, it's like one-eighth of the total stimulus. The programs run dry twice. People stopped getting their checks, and then Democrats were able to eke out more funding. But the money runs out again on Tuesday. So far, Democrats haven't been able to do anything about it.
Presumably, they'll keep trying?
Yeah, they'll definitely keep trying. But, you know, it's getting harder as conservative Republicans who are all over deficit spending gain more power. A lot of Republicans would actually like to vote for the benefits. They're popular in opinion polls. And we've never cut off benefits with unemployment so high. But Republicans blocked a funding bill for this last week. They said it added to the deficit and it wasn't offset by spending cuts. There's a chance of a deal by the end of the year that would maybe be unemployment benefits for Democrats and more tax cuts for Republicans.
Yes, the tax cuts that are set to expire. But meanwhile, potentially millions of people would stop getting checks. What does that do to the economy?
Extended unemployment is just about the biggest bang that you can get for the buck with stimulus spending. The Congressional Budget Office has done a study and estimates that for every dollar in benefits, you get almost a $2 economic boost. And that's because the money churns around locally, places like grocery stores and laundromats and repair shops. Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute explained to me that unemployed people also live hand to mouth, so it's instant stimulus.
Those are the folks that are going to have essentially no choice but to spend it immediately in their local economies. So that's essentially $5 billion going through the long-term unemployed in two businesses. And so if we don't extend those benefits, that money is taken out of the economy and businesses will have to fire people.
Now, that $5 billion a month, that's the cost of benefits, Shierholz admits it is serious money to be adding to the deficit, but not spending it could cut GDP maybe by almost 1%. And we don't have a lot of GDP to spare right now.
But as you said, there is a cost to these extended unemployment benefits. You mentioned higher deficits and, of course, also not great for GDP either.
Well, right. And that's the argument that conservative economists and politicians are making. There's also another argument, and that one says, you know, keep extending benefits and people won't look hard for work. Instead, they'll hold out for something better than that $300 a week check. The problem is that right now there are very few jobs, maybe one for every four or five people looking for a job. So in the short run, you're likely to just get a lot of desperate people, not necessarily desperate people who suddenly can find jobs.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joining us from Portland. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Sure, Thanksgiving weekend is good for shopping, but you know what else it's good for? Doing absolutely nothing. Hanging around the house, watching football. How about playing a board game or two? You know, it's been 75 years since Parker Brothers introduced the American public to Monopoly. Village Voice writer Stephen Thrasher takes a look at how the game of real estate wheeling and dealing has fared since the recession.
When I was a kid in the 80s, my parents put a game in front of me called Anti-Monopoly. The goal was to convince the world's superpowers to give up their nuclear weapons. It wasn't much fun, but neither was the Cold War. Anyway, when the economy tanked in 2008 and the belief that banks shouldn't be too big to fail dominated the national zeitgeist, I got to wondering, is Monopoly as a concept something parents still want to teach their kids? Did Monopoly remain a popular game during the Great Recession?
Monopoly sales have increased steadily and rather strongly in these last 2 years.
That's Philip Orbanes, former Parker Brothers executive and author of three books on Monopoly.
Monopoly is one of the very best sellers during recessionary times. It's a nice tonic for uncertainty, and it provides people with an opportunity to pretend that they're rich, even if real life is not treating them so well.
Consider, Orbanes says, that Monopoly sold almost 2 million games when it debuted in the 1930s.
And that's at a time when there was 20% unemployment.
Orbanes says that Monopoly is often kids' first introduction to the concept of mortgages and to saving money for financial emergencies. I tried playing the game with some kids at the Lower East Side Girls Club to see what they learned from it.
8, 9.
If I go to jail, do I pass go and get 200?
No.
You go straight to jail.
That's my stop.
These girls seem determined not to mess up like grown-ups had with excessive borrowing.
1, 2, 3, 4. I was thinking of buying something, but no. I'll wait till I become rich.
All this saving made the game drag on, forcing their counselor to step in.
Y'all have to buy stuff if y'all ever want this game to end.
Yeah, I bought it. It's mine.
And then things got competitive.
Excuse me. My rent. Unless you want to end the poor, where's my rent?
If a bunch of teens could fall for Monopoly's charms, I wondered if I could find any adults who would question it. I went all around New York City, but couldn't find even one person who'd criticize the game. I even went to the most lefty, crunchy granola place I could think of, the Park Slope Food Co-op. Surely one of those fair trade coffee-drinking, organic cotton-wearing shoppers would have something bad to say about Monopoly.
I don't really think of it as like a real estate Monopoly money sort of game. I think of it as more of a time to spend with a group of people. It's more about having fun.
So clearly my parents were in the minority questioning what Monopoly teaches. But anti-Monopoly was not the first subversive answer to the game. Philip Orbanes talked about the Soviet version, Saveopoly, which taught players to, well, save.
And unfortunately, it might be a noble ambition and something that we should all do, but in game form, it was terribly boring.
In the U.S., there's the Marxist-Monopoly mashup class struggle, where the goal is to win the revolution. And there are various versions of Recessionopoly online, but none are commercially available. Now, with Star Wars and even the Beatles lending their names to versions of Monopoly, maybe it's obvious that the last thing any game player wants to do is to take things too seriously. On Park Place in New York, about to pass go and collect $200, I'm Stephen Thrasher for Marketplace. The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the best, and please not give me more. Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Connecticut's Attorney General is the latest to add his voice to a growing chorus warning kids against using the Kardashian card. That's card with a K. The reality TV stars launched their own prepaid debit cards a couple of months ago. They cost $99.95 a year and $7.95 a month after that, and the fees don't stop there. Personal finance guru Susie Orman went after the Kardashian card earlier this week. Today, Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal said the card may violate state laws against predatory fees. Now that is a different kind of reality. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 95 points, more than 0.8%. The Nasdaq lost 8 points, about 0.3%. And the S&P 500 slid 8 points, 0.75%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. York. Coming up this week on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, will shoppers really be able to stay away from credit this holiday season?
I am a sucker for buying things for other people. If I see something perfect, I would be more ready to whip out the credit card.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend, and we'll meet you back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.